A new opera by Goldfrapp's Will Gregory about a daring European physicist.
Picard is this amazing figure in the history of aviation, of science, of general daring do. It's an amazing achievement, the sheer bravery of getting into this tiny little capsule that he made, which is probably about 6 foot, and shooting up 10 miles into the sky.
An opera about a scientist who headed for the stars.
The fact that he's kind of forgotten about now seems unfair, and so it seems like a really worthwhile thing to celebrate this voyage that he made. It felt like it would make a great piece of drama.
Picard in Space, opera in performance on 3, Wednesday night from 7 on BBC Radio 3.
This is BBC Radio 3. It's now just after 12 midday and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Nicky Haslam is an extremely successful interior designer, a fact that is sometimes eclipsed by the fact that he's an inveterate partygoer and a friend of just about everyone you've ever heard of. But you're also, Nicky, a cabaret artist.
Yes, well, that's a whole new departure. I don't know how it came about, because I really can't sing a note, but I know all the songs and I can hear them in my head. And when that came about 2 years ago, in June, in the year before last, to sing at that restaurant called Bellamy's for a week, I just thought, well, take the dare, do it, because otherwise you'll never know if you can. Mm. And it worked quite well. And then the Savoy very sweetly asked me to do it, open their Beaufort Bar in November last year.
And I think you were accompanied by Radio 3's Paul Ginnery.
I was indeed accompanied by Radio 3's Paul Ginnery, who I couldn't do it without, let's face facts. He's such a wonderful teacher, and he just leads one through it so gently and sweetly.
Were you interested in music when you were young, when you were a child?
Yes, my parents had quite a lot of musical friends. A.P. Herbert was a great friend of my dad's, and he used to come and stay quite a lot. And other musicians, not so classically minded as him, perhaps, but my mother loved Bach and Mozart and things like that. But she also did love pop songs of the time, like the Harry Lime theme and things like that. I remember endlessly, but La Vie en Rose, endlessly being on the record player. When I had polio for 2 years, she'd bring all the records of the musicals back from America, where she'd first been married to an American. And she'd bring that. So I sort of grew up with Ethel Merman shouting in my ear.
I was going to say that suffering something like polio in childhood must have had quite a profound effect on you. I mean, I think you were riding a horse when you
were... Yeah, I was riding a pony in the waves. Yes, that was the only really frightening bit, was that pain when it actually hit me, that like a sort of thunderbolt through the body. Afterwards, it was, as there was no pain, it sort of wasn't frightening. One didn't realise that one was paralysed, but just was thankful not to be in pain.
Was that a time where you feel that your life was slightly changed by that experience?
Yes, it obviously did change, because it came exactly the time I would have gone to school. So my private school years came much later. I didn't really go till I was 10 or something ridiculous. So I was incredibly badly educated as a result. But I did read quite a lot. Actually, I didn't. That's quite untrue. I couldn't read. It was read to me, because I couldn't move my arms very much. I think in a way it gave me a very sophisticated upbringing, because my parents' friends would all come and talk to me, and it wasn't at all a sort of childhood nursery that I was in anymore. So it was a change.
Do you think perhaps too that experience of being slightly imprisoned in your own body, as it were, for, perhaps meant that you luxuriated in freedom later on in being able to go out?
Oh, absolutely, yes, of course. But the minute I had to learn to walk again, I was dancing on table. I was doing the Charleston with Joan Crawford and Our Flaming Daughters, or it was.
Now, the first music, I think, does come from some early memories, doesn't it?
Yes. It's almost the first really wonderful classical piece I can remember. And then, of course, when I learnt that it had been written by Bizet when he was 17 or something, as a tribute to Haydn, it made it even more romantic, because it's so perfect, I think, the symphony in C.
And it's also, have you seen the dance? It's often
yes.
done as well. I think it's a Balanchine.
Yeah, it is a Balanchine.
It's one of the great ones.
I saw it a lot when I lived in New York.
And it's almost impossible to hear this opening, talking about getting up and jumping on a table. Yeah. It's almost impossible to hear this opening
without dancing.
Kind of joie de vivre going through
exactly.
one's body.
It's like Le Biche does the same thing.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you.
So I love that rather surprisingly abrupt ending so good too, isn't it?
It's full of kind of chatter too.
It's very talkative, isn't it? You can hear the bits where they sort of, well, the dancers want to go and sit down and be a little bit quiet for a bit and then come back and dance again. I love it.
And it's a bit like the Prokofiev Classical Symphony in that it looks back to classical forms. I mean, you're right, he was 17 when he wrote that. And it's not a bad thing, is it, in a way, to go back when you're developing your craft to the styles of the past.
All the old masters did it in painting, didn't they, after all? So I suppose the musicians did it more than one thinks, because probably their early stuff was not recorded so.
That was the first movement from the Symphony in C by Bizet. We heard the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, directed by Sir Neville Mariner. Well, talking of visual things, it was almost accidental that you became a designer, wasn't it, in some ways?
Yes, really, it was. I started off in sort of magazine design, mise en page, really in New York when I went there in the early 60s, and it developed a bit from there. But I was always quite interested in doing interior design, but never thought there was a way to learn it. There weren't any design schools then, you know. And I did a bit at my parents' house in the country. I sort of bossed them about like mad and made it look probably hideous. But then later on, I started doing stuff in New York for friends, and my house in Lambeth was quite admired by people. And then when finally I came back from America, I just thought, well, this is the only thing I know how to do properly. I better make it my so-called profession.
And now your company is very successful, and you published a book last year called Sheer Opulence.
Yes, I did indeed. Well, I thought we'd had enough of sheer minimalism, haven't we? So I thought I'd better hoe the other row, whatever the word is. But it doesn't necessarily mean I'm only opulent. I like very simple things too. But I'm not going to ever be in a rut. Every job is different.
Now, the people that you often work for, I mean, presumably, many of them, of course, are incredibly famous, but presumably you try and work out something about their character, the thing that would suit them. Or do they come to you because they want something else?
Well, obviously, one explores their character to begin with when one's first with a client. One finds out what makes them laugh. I think that's incredibly important to know what makes people laugh, because I think rooms have to have humour. I don't mean, when I say humour, I don't mean something funny in the room. Something when you walk into a room, it makes you smile. Mm. Minimalism doesn't really do that, I don't think.
Mm. So would you say that there's a Nicky Haslam recognisable style? I mean,
well, I think there's a stamp, but not a style. I don't do everything all the same. Mm. If you know my work, you'll know there's usually quite a lot of the same things in it, because I love using the same fabric. I get lots of crushes on certain fabrics or bits of furniture or something.
So characterise, just for people listening, how one of these, or even your own, if you like, house might look.
Ah, well, my own house is so-called Gothic Folly in the country that used to belong to the designer John Fowler, and it's tiny. The rooms are 12-foot square. I love small rooms, by the way. I'm always telling people, don't knock through. You'll dread it. But it's 18th century without, or 19th century without being obviously so. It's got elements of everything in it, but of all periods. But it's mostly books and nice pictures of things propped up against walls and plants and general delabre mess.
So, and if you like not too many huge rooms, but some quite a lot of small rooms, you quite like sort of intimate feel.
I love intimate feeling rooms, yes. Yeah. And it's funny how many people you could squeeze into a small room. I mean, they look much more comfortable than a great big room with perched on sofas miles apart.
Now, it's the haunting quality, I think, of this next piece that attracted you to it.
Well, this is my beloved. I just think it is haunting. I think the words are very, very beautiful. A lot of Kismet has wonderful lyrics, I think. This is a haunting piece of music. Borodin is a pretty haunting composer in many ways anyway. And I think that the Americans who adapted it did make an extraordinarily beautiful piece of near-opera out of it, really. And when Doretta Morrow comes in right at the end again and sings the whole tune straight through, it just is haunting. Imagine doing that twice a night for for 8 days a week.
Well, I was watching you, and I think you've missed your calling, Nicky Haslam. I mean, you know every single word backwards. And
I wouldn't get the notes right there. I love, there are some wonderful words. One eager mouth. This eager mouth is a beautiful phrase, isn't it?
And This Is My Beloved from Kismet. Borodin, adapted by Wright and Forrest. We heard the original Broadway cast, Alfred Drake, Doretta Morrow, Richard Kiley and Henry Calvin. It is extraordinary how one can sort of serendipitously sometimes pick things up just by listening from the radio. And I think the next piece, Nicky, was a discovery like that.
It's absolutely true. I only ever heard it once and I fell in love with it then and there. It was about 3 months ago. And I'd never even realised that Tolstoy wrote music. And I haven't heard it since, Michael, so I don't know. Perhaps I'll hate it, but I don't.
Think we'll give you a CD at the end, so you'll have a memento of it. But the fascinating thing about it was that all of those Russians, you know, I mean, Pasternak's father was a famous painter and his mother was a pianist. And so many of these people, Balanchine, Diaghilev, they did actually play the piano quite well. I gather that Tolstoy played well and played duets with his wife. This is the only piece he wrote.
Really?
I think he did write it because he used to play it.
Yeah.
And two musicians copied it down and came up with the identical music. So I think we can really genuinely say that this is indeed Tolstoy's waltz.
How wonderful to hear it again.
Very short, but absolutely lovely. Yeah. Were you pleased to hear it again?
Oh, it's wonderful. I'm thrilled.
The extraordinary thing is that you'd have thought that knocking off Anna Karenina and War and Peace would be enough without actually...
Exactly. I was just thinking, you can sort of see Natasha dance to that, can't you? Looking over her shoulder as she turns.
We heard Lera Auerbach playing Tolstoy's Waltz for piano in F major. Do you get too much music, or ballet or opera, Nicky Haslam?
I go to the opera as much as I can. Mm. Not really enough, it must be said. And something was... I had tickets the other day for the Anna Nicole Smith thing. Mm. Sadly, I had to go to Los Angeles at the last minute, so I missed it. But I'm much happier in 19th or 20th century opera than I am in 18th and even earlier.
Well, that's rather refreshing to hear for me, a composer of opera.
Well, I love French opera too, which very few people do. I love all that period. I think it's so beautiful.
Pelléas et Mélisande.
Well, odd enough, that, I mean, I know that's wonderful, but I'm too dumb to get its perfection yet, but I will do. But I like sort of...
It's all in the undercurrent.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
Our next singer is a rather remarkable woman, Diana Durbin, and she was born in the early 20s and is now still living in France, I gather.
Absolutely. Yeah. So she's getting on, but she's probably still singing. She's got this perfect voice.
She wanted to retire in 1942, which always seems a little astonishing for somebody who was thinking of retiring before you were even born. And actually, they're still alive.
Yes, it is amazing, isn't it? Of course, she was one of the great stars of late 30s and 40s movies. She sort of retired herself from movies because she didn't ever go on to be a grown-up actress. I mean, she did one or two films, but then she decided she was not for her. But what I love it is that Callas, as a child, Maria Callas, saw her movies and vowed to be an opera singer.
As a result.
As a result. Mm-hmm.
So this is, this piece?
This is a song by Frank Lesser, who better known really for writing Guys and Dolls or in a Slow Boat to China. But he wrote this, I think, supremely beautiful song called Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year, which I do sing in my cabaret act rather badly.
Tragically, I feel like crying without you, my darling. There is a very charming quality to the voice, isn't it?
It's so lilting. And of course, it's before singers sang through their noses, which they all do now.
Spring Will Be a Little Late This Year by Frank Lerser, sung by Deanna Durbin. You mentioned, Nikki Haslam, before we heard Deanna Durbin, how she inspired Callas, and we're going to hear Callas next.
Well, yes, we certainly are, because this is almost the most beautiful noise I think ever made, Callas singing the Charpentier depuis le jour. It's a rather boring opera, isn't it, actually, Louise? It's the only good thing in it, but it is just supremely beautiful. Is it an aria? I suppose it is.
Yeah. It's strange, isn't it, how one can find pieces like that, where somebody obviously had a moment of utter inspiration.
Exactly. This was Charpentier's moment supreme.
Yeah. So, Nikki, what's this song about? What's she singing about here?
Well, she's remembering her first kiss from, I suppose it was that long ago, but I suppose one always remembers one's first kiss, that eager mouth. Mm. And here she is singing about that eager mouth. And I think it's wonderful the way her voice doesn't swamp the music. It's a very astral, very strong voice. And she just tones it, if that's the word, so perfectly into this very delicate music.
Ooh.
Depuis le jour, from Louise, Act 3, by Charpentier. We heard Maria Callas with the Orchestre National de la Radiodiffusion Française, conducted by Georges Pratt. Nicky, did you enjoy your time in America? Because you spent quite a while there, didn't you?
Yes, I loved it. I went to New York in 1962, which was, of course, the heyday of America, having an aristocratic side, which has sort of slightly gone now. And the nightclubs that I loved, like El Morocco, they were still there. It was still sort of hint of the 40s and 30s in it, which has disappeared, and disappeared quite soon after I left, actually, when I went to Arizona.
And but when you went to Arizona, didn't you sort of do a Robert Redford, as it were?
Absolutely, yes. I became a ridiculously cowboyed up, you know, in all sorts of terrible shaps and grizzly bears throw, you know, with more faded denim than you can shake a stick at. But that was part of the point of it, I must say, because who hasn't wanted to be a cowboy in their lives?
But this thing of actually taking on other personalities, I mean, it's obviously something that you get a great deal of pleasure from. I mean, I remember I've seen you at one or two things, and your outfit was always very striking. And then we'll see you the next day in a completely different outfit.
Well, I'm not very satisfied with how I look all the time, so I want to try and improve on it and make it more interesting. And also, I see people looking absolutely wonderful in the street or on television. I think, I've got to look just like him tomorrow. And I've got all the clothes in the wardrobe, and I can somehow throw it together and I'll look like that person. I'll feel so happy looking, not being me.
But are you happy being you?
Yes. Now, after God knows, it's been a long enough time to learn to be me. I am happy. Yes, I am. But it was fun being a chameleon.
But you still get fun from doing that, don't you?
Yes, I get fun from having some kind of disguise, I suppose it is. Because I'm a terrible actor. Can't act for love or money. So it's put on the motley, isn't it? It's up to that.
I asked that question deliberately about America because the composer we're going to talk about next, and indeed a whole series of artists came from Europe to America. Obviously, this was before you went there. And they took on different personalities in a way, didn't they?
Exactly. Yeah, that helped, especially in Hollywood, where they all congregated to, really, all those great writers and composers. And I was lucky enough to know the von Hofmannsthal family. In fact, the youngest one is my new godson. And so I was very interested by the sort of that Austrian movement, the Secession, and all the painters, and the Klimt, and all that lot of that world. And I heard about Korngold, who we're going to hear now, quite early on. Die Tote Stadt was the first thing I heard, which I think is wonderful, but it's hard to accept it. But his film music is really very, very beautiful, I think, and slightly overlooked because people say he just sort of sold himself out to the studios. But he had to keep going. And I think he went back, didn't he? And wrote other things. But there's more and more Korngold coming out, isn't there?
He went on writing classical music, but I think it's very difficult. You know this as well as anyone, that, you know, you get labelled in this
exactly.
world. And once you were known as a film composer, it's difficult to still sustain a presence as a concert composer. But,
exactly.
but he wrote some pieces which are now, yes, very popular.
And they're getting played more, aren't they? And he's becoming more connu.
I remember once, you know, there was an extraordinary man at Radio 3 called Hans Keller.
Oh, yes.
Who really knew music backwards. And I remember I made one a sort of slightly disparaging remark, when I was young and foolish, about Korngold and I think maybe possibly Goldschmidt. And he wrote me a handwritten letter saying, "Do you really know what happened to these people?" And your comment was really not very well thought out.
Well, flippant or...
And it was a salutary exercise, actually, because you make generalisations. Oh, Korngold's a film composer.
Yeah.
Well, you don't know the circumstances behind it, and actually he was very much more than that.
Exactly.
So what are we going to hear from Korngold's film music?
Well, it's one of the pieces from The Sea Hawk, which was the Errol Flynn movie, wasn't it? But I think it works without seeing the movie. It's wonderful to listen to as well as being background music.
This is Rose Garden.
Yeah.
Thank you.
The rather fascinating thing about Korngold was that, you know, he never really lost the fact in his mind that he was a serious composer, and he used to regard these scripts as kind of opera libretti. Yes. And there are lots of leitmotifs, as in Wagner.
Yes, it's pretty original, but there's a bit of Ravel through some, isn't there? But they were all very influenced by Ravel that period, weren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Well, he was the master of orchestration.
Yeah.
But also, even at the end of this, I don't know if you knew this, Nicky Haslam, but towards the end of the film, something which is not in the script is that the men all burst into song. And so he obviously couldn't resist becoming even more operatic and added this bit, much to everybody's amazement, where the seamen all start singing.
Really? I wish we had that as well.
We heard Rose Garden from The Seahawk by Korngold. The BBC Philharmonic Orchestra were conducted by Rumon Gamba. Now, we're going to hear Wherever There's Love next, Nicky, and I wonder whether this has got anything to do with your own singing career.
Well, it has a bit, because I only found this song just before I was going to do the Cabaret at the Savoy. And I've always been obsessed by Lee Wiley. I think she's the most perfect singer there's ever been. In fact, when I knew Curl Porter in New York when I lived there, and he said he thought that Lee Wiley, was the most appropriate singer for all his music, and that she actually got the nuances better than any other singer he knew, except perhaps Ethel Merman. He admired them both equally. And I've sort of collected everything she's ever done over the years.
What was he like, Curl Porter?
Well, he was getting on when he was in pain when I met him, you know, the legs had come off, but he was very perfect and very sweet to me, and I was sort of young and fresh for him, and you know, I knew the songs, and yet wasn't blasé with him, so it was the only person I wanted to meet in my life was Cole Porter. I mean, I was brought up in longing to meet him, and I did, and it was a real honour to have known him.
Because what's so wonderful about not only being able to write those memorable songs, but the lyrics are so perfect.
Aren't they? Yes.
Funny.
Yeah, brilliant lyricist. And he had wonderful taste too. His clothes were beautiful, his food was beautiful, his apartments were wonderful. He was a very cultured man. Mm. And he looked so like a little onyx figure with these grey flannel suits and carnations. And he was just incredibly nice to me. I'm so lucky. But Lee Wiley is my all-time great jazz, I suppose. She's a jazz singer, really. And this song was the only song Eddie Condon ever wrote, I think. For her, and I did sing it. Actually, Paul Guinery was very instrumental. He dug it out for me, and we orchestrated it all. He rearranged it for my pathetic voice. But she is just extraordinary, and it's wonderful.
There's heaven. where, sir, there's a time. Wherever there's June, there's a bride. Wherever there's yellow, there's always goodbye. Wherever there's love, there's you and I.
He couldn't resist that flourish at the end on the trumpet to match the voice.
Yes.
Wherever there's love.
And the way she stretches out that goodbye. Always goodbye.
Lee Wiley singing with Eddie Condon and his orchestra in Condon's Wherever There's Love. You mentioned Cole Porter, and it's very fascinating to hear about him because obviously his songs occur on the programme quite often. I wonder, especially in the sort of creative world, are there people that have really made a strong impression on you? I mean, really inspiring people.
Oh, many of that, especially of that world I met then, or in Paris. Cocteau was interesting to have met. And Alice Toklas was quite funny to have met too. Whether she made depression, I don't know, because I did love the autobiography by Gertrude Stein. I was obsessed by that when I was young. And then somebody who actually was called Fulco Madura, who was a jeweller who used to come and stay at the ranch in Arizona. He was the one who really turned me on to opera. And he was very inspirational for me. I was incredibly lucky. Odd people like Mambosche, the dress designer, and things like that. I mean, I was incredibly lucky to have met pre-war people, if you know what I mean by that. Mm-hmm. Cecil Beaton and all that were Diana Cooper. I was so lucky to meet these people that had been alive in the great period of England, in a way.
I'm interested in Cocteau in particular and what kind of personality he had.
Well, he was quite old when I met him. It was in the Palais Royal, and I think there was quite a lot of the opium down him when I saw him. So he wasn't exactly sparkling, but he was exactly like you expected to be, sort of sardonic and slightly hooded-eyed and, you know.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because we were talking about New York and we were talking about Vienna, that time when there was, the birth of psychoanalysis. There are these places which become hothouses, weren't they? Paris in the 20s,
yes.
And then Berlin,
absolutely.
And Eisler and Kurt Weill and Brecht.
Yeah.
And then in New York, possibly when you were there. I mean, these places have their moment, don't they?
Well, I think then it went to Hollywood, really, because it was such a feast of talent when the film industry started. And then New York, I think you're quite right. That's the next. And then it sort of shifted back to London in a way. Mm-hmm. And luckily it stayed.
We're going to finish, Nicky Haslam, with some music from Tosca, a very famous aria. But I think there was quite an important story behind your choice of this opera.
Well, it's obviously Vici d'Arte, which is one of the great pieces of music ever written, I suppose, sung by a woman I love called Luba Velich, with an extraordinary harsh voice. She was Bulgarian, but she sang in the Vienna Opera, and then all over the world. I love this very harsh voice.
Sometimes these cutting notes in these sort of arias can be really very exciting and thrilling, can't they?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't know that one would necessarily want to hear it in everything, but sometimes it just really goes right through you.
Yeah, where she says, "Perché, signore?"
Yes, and I thought you'd like to think of her as you listen to this, because she's described as a Rubenesque red-haired beauty.
Yes, well, most Bulgarians are red-haired, aren't they? but at the end of it, which we can't hear on this recording, Tosca says that when she's killed Scarpi, she says, "Evanta lui tremata tutta Roma," before him all Rome trembled. And Fulco Verdura told me that when he was young, everybody who went to the opera would sit on the edge of their seats, whether it was the San Carlo or the Scala or the Rome Opera or whatever, waiting for the soprano to say those words. And it made or broke her reputation whether she got those words out. They're only said, "Evanta lui tremata tutta Roma." It was the most important thing in the whole of opera.
Well, since we're more interested in the music, we'll have the bit before, and then we'll have to imagine.
Yeah, we'll have to imagine the tutta Roma.
Declamation.
Yeah.
Oh,
Ljuba Velić sang Visidate from Tosca, Act 2, by Puccini. We heard the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra of New York, conducted by Max Rudolph. Well, thank you very much, Nicky Haslam, for taking us into passions of yours that are not so often broadcast as some of the others.
Well, Visidate, we live for art, don't we? You do, anyway.
Thank you.
That was Nicky Haslam talking to Michael Barclay. Next Sunday, there's no edition of Private Passions, but on Easter Sunday, the 24th of April, Michael's guest will be Eric Knowles, the expert on ceramics and glass, who's particularly well known to devotees of the Antiques Roadshow on BBC Television. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3, and today's edition was produced by Sarah Cropper. Well, a very good afternoon to you from me, Ian Skelly, here to guide you through the afternoon here on Radio 3. It's a pretty glorious afternoon in many parts of the UK today, and it's pretty good here on Radio 3 too. We'll be learning the origins and the history of the Passacaglia in just a moment. Music by Lully, Monteverdi and Bach will tell the story in the early music show. That's after a summary of the news this lunchtime, with the time now at 1 o'clock. The news is read by John Shea.
The Chief Secretary to the Treasury, Danny Alexander, has said that the government is to take legal action to recoup billions of pounds paid out to cover the deposits of British savers in collapsed Icelandic banks. A settlement to reimburse the UK was rejected by Icelanders for a second time in a referendum yesterday, a result described by Mr. Alexander as disappointing. Lawyers for two of the News of the World's phone hacking victims have said the paper's apology and offer of compensation aren't enough. The paper is thought to be offering settlements to at least 8 people whose answer phone messages were listened to, although lawyers are predicting more people will come forward now that the paper has admitted liability. A gunman who shot dead 6 people in a Dutch shopping centre yesterday before killing himself has been named as 24-year-old Tristan van der Vlies. He was a member of a shooting club and had a permit for 5 weapons, including the machine gun he used in the attack. The Royal College of Nursing is holding its annual conference today and has warned that increasing numbers of its members are considering industrial action over cuts to NHS staffing in England. The Department of Health says any efficiency savings won't adversely affect patient care. The people of Omar will hold a rally for peace this afternoon to send a message to the bombers who murdered Constable Ronan Kerr in the town last weekend. Hundreds of people are expected to march through the town, where 29 people were killed in a bombing by the Real IRA in 1998. The rally comes a day after a £500 bomb was found under a van near the main Belfast to Dublin road near Newry. The government is to ban councils in England from trying to fine householders who break the rules on rubbish collections and stop them from imposing extra charges for removing waste. Ministers say they want to stop people being penalised for such offences as leaving bins out once they've been emptied or filling them so that the lids won't close. And the weather. It'll be a fine, dry and warm day with long sunny spells. It'll become increasingly cloudy in northern and western parts of Scotland and Northern Ireland with outbreaks of mainly light rain. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at just after 2 minutes past one.
We begin a series of four programmes on the history of the American Civil War later today. On Radio 3, Adam Smith travels to Virginia to investigate the legacy of the war, which ended slavery but destroyed much of the South and claimed the lives of a fifth of the men of fighting age. In part one, he considers the war from the South's perspective, its defeat, and the long-term impact that's had on that part of the USA. The American Civil War, in our Sunday feature at 9:30 tonight. But next, this afternoon, the second of this weekend's early music shows with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to our little hour of merriment and a question for you. How do you get from this to this? No, the answer isn't simply pay an orchestra to come into the studio, which might be a bit of a tight fit. No, it's all about a particular form of music and its journey through time, a form that was originally just a simple chord pattern, as we heard strummed on the guitar, but would end up being incorporated into all kinds of works over the centuries. And it's called the Passacaglia. Harpsichordist Rinaldo Alessandrini with a Passacaglia by Juan Cabanilles, organist at Valencia Cathedral during the late 1600s. So where did the Passacaglia form actually originate? Well, like Cabanilles, it came from Spain, the word pasar meaning to walk and calle meaning a street. So we might reasonably deduce that it was originally some kind of street music, a lone guitarist perhaps playing as he wandered around amongst the crowds at a festival or something. But gradually, this simple chord sequence was taken up by all sorts of composers throughout Europe until there was hardly a single piece, vocal or instrumental, that didn't in some way feature a passacaglia, from madrigals or complex keyboard variations to ballet music in some elaborate French court opera. But for its next appearance, we must turn to the earlier part of the 17th century and to Italy, where the Spanish five-course guitar was now becoming popular. Mind you, at this stage, the Passacaglia was still a pretty simple kind of sound, as we find in a book of guitar music by Girolamo Montesardo, published in Florence. It contains 11 pages of passacaglias, all based on the same traditional chord sequence and rhythms. Montesado described those basic strumming exercises as easy and necessary for those who want to learn how to play the passacaglia. After him came another Italian, Briseño, who published a collection of songs, each one with a little passacaglia as an introduction. And it wasn't long before the idea of a short strummed passacaglia was seen as the perfect till ready on the stage. In other words, a sort of vamp or musical interlude in, say, an opera or a musical play. It would allow the singer time to get in position, to take a breath, or simply just to warn the audience to stop chatting, which they were very often doing while waiting for their favourite aria to begin. You get that sort of thing in Monteverdi's Coronation of Poppea of 1642, one of the very first operas to feature a historical event rather than Greek mythology. The aria Il Giorno Femminile starts and finishes with the same lilting instrumental passacaglia, and we also hear it in the middle as well. It's a sort of Gather Ye Rosebuds moment. The evening of a woman's life begins at noon. From midday, her beauty is on the wane. For young girls, in the morning of their lives, love keeps them company. Don't waste these verdant months, because in a few short hours, ripeness turns to decay.